Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Brian Lehrer's Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, April 14th. I'm Matt Katz from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian today. Did you see that last night? Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. That law is now contingent on a pending Florida Supreme Court decision, but it's another indication that the American South is becoming off limits for almost all abortions for almost all reasons. We're going to try to sort out what's going on with abortion rights throughout this country and talk about conflicting rulings on mifepristone, the abortion drug, with an appeals court partial block of a Texas judge's attempt to outright ban it. And we're going to zoom out to talk about how the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade is affecting national politics. And for this, we're joined by Jessica Valenti, founder of the Substack newsletter Abortion Every Day and a feminist author of multiple books on women and politics. Jessica was last on the show for a book she edited with Jacqueline Friedman called Believe Me, How Trusting Women Can Change the World. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
And by way of full disclosure, Jessica is married to WNYC Chief Content Officer Andrew Golis, and she is also very much the go-to writer and thinker on issues related to all things feminism, or its verb form, feministing, the title of your blog from the early 2000s, of which I was a fan of back then, so I remember.
Oh, well. Wow. Old school. Oh, yeah. Old school.
Yeah,
okay.
I feel like we go way back. So to start... To start off on all of this, let's talk about the ruling from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and
Sure. Try
to add a little bit of clarity. A week ago, a Trump-appointed federal judge in Texas rules that the FDA was wrong to approve the use of the abortion drug mifepristone back in 2000, and the judge said it can no longer be sold, but the judge also stayed his own decision for a week to allow for an appeal. That appeal happened, mm-hmm. goes to the Fifth Circuit, upholds part of the decision, but not the whole ban. I know you aren't a lawyer, but are you able to explain what they upheld and what they deemed invalid and what this all really means on the ground?
Sure. So they ruled that mifepristone, which is the first of two pills that you take to end a pregnancy, they ruled that mifepristone can stay on the market. But they essentially put so many restrictions on it. They agreed with so many of these really onerous restrictions that it makes it really hard to say that they are actually allowing it to be accessible, right? So they ruled that you can't dispense mifepristone through the mail, that you can't prescribe it over telehealth, which is a huge deal, that someone needs to be, you know, in person in a doctor's office, and that it can't be given out by healthcare providers who aren't physicians. And so basically, they ruled against all of these really onerous restrictions that the FDA had done away with. And so it's sort of their way of trying to pretend that they are being moderate on this by allowing mifepristone, but allowing all of these ridiculous restrictions that are not necessary for a drug that has, you know, been used safely and effectively for over 20 years.
Right. And then there's also this other Washington State decision. So the Washington mm-hmm. State federal judge who ruled, in contradiction of the Texas judge, the FDA could not alter its current policy on mifepristone. So
right. This
is going to end up at
this is where it gets
SCOTUS,
confusing.
Right? Yeah, right.
Yes, it gets very confusing. So there was a conflicting ruling that has the same standing as the ruling that came out of Texas, that 17 states and D.C. signed on to, saying actually the FDA's restrictions are too much and we want more access to mifepristone. And so what's happened is that these states in D.C. who signed on to this lawsuit are not privy to the restrictions that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals implemented, which sounds completely chaotic and ridiculous, right? They signed on to this lawsuit, and so now they actually don't have to put those restrictions on mifepristone. They can continue prescribing mifepristone as they have been. But this is sort of part of the point, right? Like, the Republican strategy here is to sow as much chaos as possible, to make things as confusing as possible, so that women on the ground have no idea what is legal or not. And so that doctors and pharmacists, no matter what state they're in, are afraid, are scared. The legal situation is changing day to day, hour to hour. And so it causes this complete mess where people can't get the care that they need.
Is the Supreme Court going to ultimately or maybe imminently weigh in?
Yeah, the Biden administration has asked them to weigh in as an emergency, because all of this is so urgent and imminent. It is unclear to me how that is going to turn out, right? We saw what happened with Roe v. Wade, obviously, but the ruling out of Texas was so ridiculous on so many counts. And so anyone who sort of takes themselves seriously as a judge might have a difficult time allowing this to go on. But who knows? And that's what's so difficult about this moment. And that's why I'm doing the newsletter that I'm doing, where I'm, you know, writing about abortion every day, because it really is changing constantly. And it can be hard to keep up.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the way you keep up with this, Jessica, the intensity and unique way you've been covering this issue. You put out a newsletter on abortion rights every day at abortioneveryday.com. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to cover abortion like this?
You know, it sort of happened organically, because, you know, I was already a writer. I had a Substack. There was so much happening that I just found I was already writing about it every day. So I figured let's formalize this. But really, at the end of the day, I did it because I wanted to get a handle on what was going on. I've been doing this for nearly 20 years, right? Writing about feminism, writing about abortion rights. If I'm confused, if I'm having a hard time keeping up, I cannot imagine everyday Americans having an easy time understanding what is happening with abortion rights in the political landscape. And so the hope is to make this a little bit more understandable, to try to like throw a wrench in that chaos and help people just know what their rights are.
You also write about people who are caught up in this issue on the edges, not necessarily women seeking abortions, but maybe women with miscarriages or pregnancy complications, because they're caught up in all of this and affected seriously by this, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, anyone who has the ability to get pregnant has been affected by this and will be affected by this. We've seen lots of cases come out of these states with abortion bans where someone is miscarrying. It is clear that this pregnancy is not going to survive. There is nothing to do. But because there's still a fetal heartbeat, they won't give these women care. And so what ends up happening is that they wait and they wait. And we've seen cases where women have gone septic. They've ended up in the ICU. They've ended up having to have hysterectomies, because that was the only legal way doctors figured that they could end the pregnancy to save their life. It is so much worse than anyone can possibly imagine. And the thing to remember, too, is that we are only hearing a very small percentage of the stories, right? The people who are coming out with these experiences are people who feel safe enough to, who feel secure, who feel like they're okay going to the media. That's a very small percentage of people who are comfortable sharing their most tragic and personal stories with the country.
Are people contacting you directly, women across the country or medical providers, about their experiences?
Yes. Too many for me to handle, to be honest. Every single day I'm hearing another story from a woman who is denied care, a doctor who is horrified by what their state is requiring them to do, and who wants advice or who wants to talk or who wants to share their story. And the overwhelming thing around all of this is fear, I think, for a lot of them, especially doctors, right? They contact me, they want to help, they want to do better, but they're operating in states where they could lose their medical license, where they could be, not just criminalize and sent to prison, but civilly fined, right? So there's all of these barriers for them to provide the care that their patients need. And that's why we're seeing, you know, in states like Idaho is losing half of its OBGYNs and maternal fetal specialists. Half. Like, hospitals are shutting down their maternity wards in Idaho because they cannot hire OBGYNs to work there.
Tim in Brooklyn. Hi there, Tim.
Hey, Matt. I'm calling for the medical community, just on that exact subject which we left off on, to grow a spine and to uphold their oath to do no harm and give the drugs that are proven effective and do the least harm. In effect, I'm calling for a movement of some in the medical community of civil disobedience. When we know the science and we know that this is just political misogyny entrenching misogyny into law yet again, and the medical community has an obligation to take care of the patients. And of course, not everyone can risk going to jail. I understand that, but let's grow a spine here, people. Let's provide the care. And you know, if we need to make, you know, some martyrs, there should be some people in the position to stand up to this and call it what it is and provide the care. Women's
Jessica,
lives and health are at stake.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Well, Jessica, what do you make of that? Can the medical community organize here and do that sort of, sort of mass civil disobedience?
There definitely have been calls for that. I want to start by saying the medical community in all of these states, doctors in all of these states, have been extraordinarily vocal about the harm that this is doing to patients. And so I just want to make clear they're doing a lot there, right? That said, there have been calls for civil disobedience, and there's been some conversations about whether older doctors, older OBGYNs, want to step up and be the ones who are breaking the law. There's conversations about, okay, who can afford to go to prison, who can't, who's towards the end of their career and maybe losing their license, will not mean the same thing to them, which is a horrifying conversation to have, right? That is a horrifying conversation where doctors in anti-choice states are having to talk about, okay, who's the best person to lose their license and go to prison? Mm-hmm. It's chilling, honestly.
Ashish in West Windsor, New Jersey is also calling. Hi there, Ashish. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Morning, Matt. So I have a daughter, right? And we actually moved from Texas to New Jersey 5 years ago. And I thank my stars for making the decision at that time. What I wonder is, what do the common people think, right? So why is this in the hand of politicians? Because the nation is divided between red and blue. And states like Texas, they're talking about banning websites now that will talk about abortion.
Yeah.
Tomorrow they could go ahead and ban your radio show, right? So who will ever, how will you ever be able to have an open dialogue about this? In at least the red states.
Yeah, Jessica?
This is such a terrific and important question. I want to say the vast majority of Americans are pro-choice. The vast majority of Americans are horrified by these abortion bans, do not want to see abortion restricted. And that is not just true in blue states. That is true in red states. That is true across the board, right? You go to some of these states and you take these polls and politicians are shocked. And this is part of the reason that across multiple states, Republicans are working really hard to make it impossible for people to pass pro-choice ballot measures, right? We saw pro-choice wins with ballot measures in Kentucky, in Kansas, places where you wouldn't necessarily think that that would happen. And so now you have states like Ohio and Missouri, where Republicans there are trying to push through legislation that says, you know what, if you want to pass a ballot measure, you need to have 60% of the vote instead of a simple majority. They are doing all sorts of anti-democratic workarounds to try to keep voters as far away from abortion as possible because they know that abortion rights are so incredibly popular, right? And that really gets at the heart of this issue to me. This is not about abortion as a controversial issue that Americans are evenly split on. We're not. This is about a small group of powerful extremist legislators and organizations enacting restrictions on abortion that the majority of Americans do not want.
But those decisions are also being affirmed by the courts, often.
In some cases, yes. In some cases, because we have these conservative extremist courts, or we have judge shopping, as we saw in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. But we also have places like in Montana, for example, right? In Montana, the abortion rights are protected in the state constitution. And so what Republicans are doing in Montana is they are trying to make it so that people are not allowed to vote for in state Supreme Court elections, so that the governor can appoint justices to the state Supreme Court, and so that the people who are interpreting the state constitution are all conservatives. Or they're trying to pass bills that say legislators have the same right to interpret the state constitution as the state Supreme Court does. And so they are also messing with the credibility of the court in order to ban abortion, right? They are pulling out all the stops.
Joythi in Yonkers is on the line. Joythi, are you there?
Yes, I am. Jessica, first of all, thank you so much for what you're doing. You're amazing. I can't believe like how much strength you have to like just do this every day. But anyway, I follow you on TikTok and I think you're amazing.
My question is
about the way this case was brought. These anti-abortion doctors judge shopped, found this judge, and mm-hmm. how is it that they have standing? How is it that they are directly affected? How can they argue that? I don't understand that.
Yeah, it's a real
question.
I think so. It's a real problem, and I'm actually going to be on a panel later today about this very thing and about the issue of how do we protect democracy in the courts? How is it possible that something like this could happen, where an anti-choice organization could go and form, by the way, they didn't exist. They went and they formed the organization in Amarillo, Texas, because that is where this judge was, because they knew they wanted this judge. They handpicked this judge. And by the way, this is a judge that they found out, they found social media pictures of his kids wearing I Survived Roe v. Wade shirts, right? This is not a judge who hides his activism. This is an anti-abortion activist judge. They handpicked this judge. And it's reflected in the ruling, right? Like the entire ruling is just peppered with anti-abortion language, false rhetoric. And it does terrify me that this was allowed to happen. And this is why you see so many law professors, legal experts talking about this, not just how it relates to abortion, but the integrity of our court system.
Jessica, we've been talking a lot about the courts and the saying that these decisions don't reflect the larger mm-hmm. popular opinions on this issue. But in the wake of the Dobbs decision, state legislatures, where the name of the game for anti-abortion legislators for so long has been to chip away at Roe, we're seeing them, pass these bills. I mean, these are elected legislators who are passing bills limiting, or basically almost banning abortions. Last mm-hmm. night in Florida, Governor DeSantis signed a bill passed by the state legislature to ban abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. I saw a tweet in reference to this yesterday from New York State Senator Julia Salazar. She said, 4 years ago, I had to terminate a pregnancy through a medication abortion here in New York. It was not a tough decision for me. I knew then and know now it was the right thing to do. But she says, I found out I was pregnant at 7 weeks. So banning abortion at six mm-hmm. weeks really makes it essentially an outright abortion ban, doesn't it? Can you talk a little bit about what's happening at the state level in these state houses?
Sure. Yes, that amounts to a total abortion ban, right? 6 weeks is before most people will know that they're pregnant. And that is part of the point. And the other thing to know is that a lot of these bills are incredibly extreme. The bill that DeSantis signed last night, for example, it, you know, bans abortion, the exceptions, and I put exceptions in scare quotes, for rape and incest are so onerous that no one would ever be able to use them, which is part of the point, and that's the case with all rape and incest exceptions. There's language in the bill that says that it is criminal, it is a felony for anyone who actively participates in an abortion. So that doesn't just mean a doctor, the person who's getting an abortion. That is so broad that it could mean if you drive someone to get an abortion, that could be a criminal act. If you lend someone money for an abortion, that could be a criminal act. And so we're seeing this, like, just this complete mess in these states, and they're taking it as far as they possibly can, right? Like we saw in Idaho, they passed what they're calling an abortion trafficking bill, where they're trying to criminalize anyone who takes a teenager out of state for abortion care. So if a teenager has their grandmother or their aunt drive them to Washington from Idaho, that grandmother or aunt could go to prison for 2 to 5 years. And so they are really going all out, but at the same time that they are passing this really extreme legislation, they are pretending as if they're not. They're pretending as if there's exceptions. They're pretending as if women won't be criminalized, because they know that abortion rights are so popular, right? And so they're trying to tweak their messaging about these really extremist laws.
Jessica Valenti writes abortioneveryday.com on Substack. She's a feminist author of many books, co-editor of Believe Me, How Trusting Women Can Change the World. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us for this conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.